BBC Five Live.
For a lot of us, Fevzy, we'll be wondering, how do we use this piece of technological advancement that we got as a present at Christmas? We didn't even ask for it some of the times. And it got me to thinking about back in the day when these little computer cars that we used to have back in the, you know, you're probably too young to remember this, back in the 70s, they were the height of technology. And Harry in Pompey knows what I'm talking about because he sent me a text about it. He says, Dawson computer cars, Christmas, possibly 69. I didn't realise I was that old. Like Ford GT40. Mine was a white one, twin black stripes. I think I had that one as well, actually, one year. And then the next year I had the black one with twin, oh, you know, the opposite, whatever it was. Anyway, twin white stripes to the black one. Anyway, he says, white graph card, 6-inch rule size, side cutout, steer, flip, program 2. Do you understand that?
Bit before my time, actually.
Yeah, I know, but you could still understand
it. What was it?
Well, it was these cars, and the cars look good, to be honest. The cars look really good, but the way that they worked computer-wise is that you had a little sort of a card. You know, if you can imagine three lengths of a credit card, you know, so a card that's out of cardboard, and you were able to cut out little inserts in the side of it, which would tell it either to go left or to go right.
So it was a punch paper card.
A punch paper card, yeah.
So,
that's a good
so the forerunner to magnetic tape storage, where you know you see old films with sort of giant computers with reel-to-reel type tapes on them, but the forerunner to that was either punch paper tape or punch paper cards. And I had a friend, it shows how old I am, whose job it was to stack the cards for the computer. It wasn't to type in anything or store it on magnetic tape or disc, but it was actually to get the cards all in order. And this sort of technology actually has been around for a long time because essentially that's...
rubbish,
what,
though.
It is in terms of storage density, but things like player pianos, you didn't need a high data rate for that.
It's the same thing, isn't it? It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
But the reason why I was talking about it was, imagine if we'd had a techie phone in back in those days, because usually you got the present, you opened it up, Father Christmas delivered it early in the morning, so you got it's 5 minutes after Father Christmas made his exit up the chimney, and you open up the present and you start playing with your car that you got as a present. By midday, it was broken. Literally, by midday, every single year. I think I got them 2 years in a row. It was broken by midday. Anyway, never mind that. Keep that thought in mind because Caroline is here in Ripon in North Yorkshire. You've got a question for Fevzy, Caroline.
Yes, hi, everybody. Happy New Year, if we can
happy
still
New
say
Year
that.
To you Caroline, as well. Absolutely, you can.
Yeah, basically what it is, I have to renew my subscription for antivirus very shortly.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like car insurance. If you stay with the same insurer, you're going to pay more. So it looks as though I'm probably going to just, you know, like basically not do what the antivirus current supplier would like me to do and just subscribe, because that seems more expensive than just buying one. Somebody's discount, whatever price. Could you add, you know, advise what's the current, you know, good old antivirus? And B, should I be swapping from, say, antivirus supplier A to antivirus supplier B? How do I sort of basically uninstall and then install new supplier without having a horrible gap in the middle when something nasty might creep in?
Caroline, these are all great observations and an excellent set of questions. May I commend you on those? So first of all, you're quite right. If you set up antivirus subscriptions just to automatically renew, you will pay the highest possible price that they think they can get away with without blushing. And frankly, they don't blush easily, these companies. No, you don't do that. But that doesn't mean you can't carry on with the same supplier. It just means you switch off the auto renew and search for a good deal, and you buy that deal. You can buy it, you know, you can buy it from online retailer, for example. It doesn't have to be directly from, you know, Symantec or McAfee or whoever it is. And you buy the deal typically for about a quarter of that price. And then if you've chosen the same company, I don't say you have to, but you have the choice. Very often, all you need to do is provide the code and not even do a reinstallation. So, you know, that's assuming you get the same supplier and the same set of features. However, there is also the option to go for a 1 month free subscription, because most of them offer that free trial period,
mm-hmm.
and then buy and thereby get 13 months instead of 12 for your money, because then all you do is, you having downloaded the free trial, you can often then just buy it from somewhere, enter the code, not have to reinstall again and keep going. So for example, that works with Norton. So you can go onto Norton's UK website, choose which one you want as a free download for a trial. If you're happy with it, then buy that software from somewhere, not necessarily Symantec's website themselves, but maybe from Amazon or one of any number of other retailers. And there are deals. You know, if you look at a website called hotukdeals.com and you search for antivirus, you'll find that all these deals pop up. They're not all up all the time, but they're up a fair amount of the time, so it's worth looking out for it. And the other thing to think about now is that a lot of these packages come with a multi-device license. That means that it won't necessarily just protect your PC, but let's take the Norton as an example. You can get one that will allow you to do 5 or even 10 devices in a year. And those would include, say, a Windows PC, an Apple Mac, an Android phone, an iOS tablet. You know, you can actually cover the bulk of your devices to under one fee, and then it becomes quite affordable when you look at it in that way. And interestingly, that difference between, say, the 5 license and the 10 device license can be as little as £2.
So
then you've got this situation where you get an extra 5 devices for that. And, you know, if you've got family members and so forth, you can share them. The only thing is, those all run concurrently, so they have the start date of the first installation or the date of download. So instead of paying around £40, you can certainly pay around 20 and sometimes around 10, depending on the deals that are on.
Wow.
Yeah. You just look around, have a look at the website that I've mentioned to you, look on Amazon. Be careful of buying from well-known auction websites, these sorts of things, because a lot of the codes that they sell there are legitimate, but some are not, and it's actually quite hard to tell the difference between the two. So although you don't have to buy from, you know, the producer, be it, you know, ESET or Norton or Bitdefender or whatever, although you don't have to buy from them in particular, you should buy from a reputable retailer. And then you get a choice. You can either, you know, send away and wait for them to post you a box, or you can often just get the download code by email within a minute or two of completing the purchase, and that's often a neater way. So that's a bit of general advice. So one way around the problem that you mentioned is to just go with the same supplier, and therefore you don't have to install and uninstall. You are right in pointing out that if you go for a different one, that you have to avoid this sort of risk period, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and you shouldn't really have two pieces of antivirus running on a computer at the same time, because they don't play well together. They try and grab the same file for scanning, and then the system either becomes unstable or unspeakably slow. So, you know, having two antiviruses active at the same time is not generally a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, Windows 10 have obviously thrown in a rather more security software, shall we say, like firewall and so on. And my current, I mean, I don't mind saying it's McAfee. I've been with for a year. They're, you know, pretty decent. So far, so good kind of thing. They kind of fight, you know, and so that is a bit of a problem.
So in terms of how you do this upgrade without leaving yourself vulnerable, and you're right, because if you uninstall your existing antivirus and then download whilst online the new one, then that's not good. So what you need to do is, if you're going to download the antivirus, for example, download it and put it on something like the download file on something like a USB stick, yeah, and mm-hmm. then you disconnect from the internet, uninstall the old one, install the new one, and as it's just been downloaded, the definition should be reasonably up to date. And then when you then attach to the internet again, having uninstalled old, installed new off a USB stick or even a CD, if we're going to be old school about it. And then when you reattach the internet, the first thing you do is then update, so that you make sure that you've got any updates that are then available that, that weren't part of that initial download. So that's what you need to do. And the key is make sure that you're not connected, physically disconnect from the internet at the time that you uninstall the existing antivirus. One
genius.
More point.
I can't imagine why now you say it. It seems really obvious, Feb, but you know that's what you're there for.
Well, bless you. But the main attack vector into a machine is via the internet. It's not the only one. So do make sure that that USB stick that you plugged in has been antivirus checked before you use that as a source, yeah, because it's not the only way that viruses get in. I would just say one thing, and I'll say this sensitively. Choice of antivirus software is a personal choice. My personal choice is that I think there are better options than McAfee. And I'll put it no more strongly than that. Norton do a good product. ESET do a good product. Kaspersky technically do a good product, but unfortunately have been rather wrapped up in scandal and controversy about whether they have unhealthy connections to the Russian state, being originally a Russian company. So although in the past I've been an advocate of Kaspersky software, given that there are equally good alternatives that don't have the same question marks hanging over them, then that's probably not one I'd recommend at the moment. But similarly with McAfee, I think it's quite interesting because almost every new computer that you buy, the bulk of them, if they come with any sort of antivirus on there, the bulk of them come with McAfee. And that's often an indication that they don't find it easy to sell. They have to install it and then have you remove it from a system. If I had a machine, if I buy a new machine, I was looking at a Dell laptop recently and it came with McAfee and I thought, I'm going to have to spend 20 minutes getting that all the bits of that off before I put an antivirus that I like. So if you're happy with it, by all means, stick with it. But I believe that there are probably better options.
Caroline, thanks very much. And good luck with that as well, by the way. I think we've got a result on this. Amazematics, the fantastic car with a brain by Hasbro in 1969, I think is what we were talking about. How worried should everyone be about the problem with Intel and AMD computer chips from Kyo? We did it earlier on in the program, actually. This is a huge computer virus, is it not, that's affecting hardware as well as all sorts of...
Yeah, so this is a vulnerability rather than a virus that's been found. It's two separate vulnerabilities, actually, that between the two of them affect almost every Intel processor chip in the last 20 years, which is fairly devastating. It's a vulnerability because modern processors and even 20-year-old processors have a huge number of transistors on them, effectively. I mean, in some cases, billions of transistors. And it's very hard to design those, even though we use computer tools to design them, because a human being couldn't draw a billion transistors in their lifetime, much less make them work properly. So we use computers to do that, but even so, it's very easy for errors, design errors, to work into the architecture, the design of the chip. The two vulnerabilities that have been found are serious because they deal with the very heart of the chip, what's called the kernel. That's kernel with a K, K-E-R-N-E-L, where this deals with how the chip moves data around its internal memory, how it does that. And they've found that because of this vulnerability, it's easy to trick the processor into giving up data that it would otherwise not give up, and therefore it is possible to write software, malware, viruses, as you've said, that can take advantage of those vulnerabilities in order to either take control of a machine or steal data from it.
How worried should we be?
I think there's not really much point in worrying because there's not much we can do about it at the moment. I think that software manufacturers are working very hard to not give those any such programs an ability to run. I mean, one thing that we can do as a precautionary measure is go into our browser settings and stop them from loading ads. A lot of browsers have got ad blocker software built into them now, because ads are one of the ways in which programs can run within a browser. Yeah, so web pages are no longer these static things. They have programs running within them. One of the common ways in which adverts are displayed is to have programs running within them. So by blocking those ads, that's bad for people that require advertising income, but in terms of short term for keeping us safe, that's probably a good idea. In the meantime, the manufacturers of browsers and other software are updating their software to try and mitigate this risk. But really, I think there's not a lot we can do about it, really. So I don't think we should worry, other than to say, keep backups of your data, which is always good advice anyway. Keep regular backups, have those backups stored off-site, you know, either in the cloud or on a hard drive kept at another location. And be aware that whatever you do on a computer is not completely secure, be it on the internet or not.
I think people know that by now, or should do.
Do you know what? It's amazing what people still commit to computers. And that's okay that we do that, but that we have to understanding that, you know, it's nothing is completely secure. So, you know, but in terms of worrying about it, I personally don't advocate worrying, because there's nothing we can really do.
Hold that thought. We've got Neil in London. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks very much. Yeah, you've got a techie question for Fabsy. Go ahead.
Yes. We've got two Windows 7 Pro machines acting as servers to a small network. We're thinking of adding another machine like that Windows 7 Pro to act like a backup machine to the two servers. So if any of the two servers was to go down, the backup machine can automatically take over, and the files which are on the hard drives will be the same as the other ones. So not necessarily a machine to back up to, having a backup file, but one which works as a backup pretty much in tandem. I've looked at the Windows backups system, and it doesn't do that. It just does normal backups. Do you have any sort of recommendations on how we could do that? How we can get the backup machine to act, running in duplicate as a backup?
I mean, one thing you can do with that, Neil, is you can set up a server, a separate server. So instead of just having sort of only the Windows 7 Pro machines, you can have a separate machine running Windows Server software, which would then change the way in which, you know, you can use it. You can have a peer-to-peer network, but you can also have what's called client server, where you have a server which has a central repository of all the files and serves them out to the Windows 7 Pro machine. So in that way, you then have a sort of a serious operating system which is designed for the sort of use that you want, much better sort of backup tools built into it, much more robust as well, and more expandable if you ever want to go towards more machines. And it doesn't need to be, you know, you can buy a dedicated server, you know, and you can buy these machines quite cheaply. They don't have to be expensive. Some of the HP servers, they sell them, you know, more or less as bare bones machines, just the processor, and you put in the amount of RAM you want, the amount and type of hard drives that you want, and you load your own operating system on it, and you can put something like Windows Server on it and go that way. That would then give you a lot more flexibility. It would have that benefit of everything being stored on a central server, which makes it easier to back up as well, because, you know, otherwise you have this situation where not only do you have the data on different machines, but the data can become out of sync, you know, and if two machines are trying to access the same data, then which version is the correct one? If you have a server serving up the files, that helps solve those problems.
Okay, I'm not very much aware of that, but I think my initial was with I wanted to go with the client server route, but my two issues were firstly cost, and then secondly was configuring it and working and operating it as a one-man band business that does trying to do everything myself. And we've only got a maximum of about 10 machines in there at the moment. We're only running about 5.
Yep.
The cost of having almost 3, well, at least 2 server softwares could be significant, as well as the administration of that, unless you have a, there's a different option you recommend.
Is that why you've got the servers, because of your business? Do you run a server company or whatever it is?
I own a small audiovisual and lighting company, and we've got like a database application that sits on Microsoft, either client or server. It's not necessarily massive.
Okay. I'm sorry, yes, Neil. Sir. Carry on. I beg your pardon. I interrupted you. Carry on, please.
Oh, yeah. So it's on. We've got a separate machine for the database, which the application sits on and runs on. And because it's such a small, tiny network, it could work happily in Windows Pro.
Yeah.
Hence why we've gone down that road rather than going the server client.
I understand. Okay, so if I may dive in. So if you want to have a more sophisticated backup and recovery system, but don't want to go to the expense, and you're right, obviously it does cost more to have a sort of client-server network and have that expandability and robustness, then we can look at better software that's better than what's baked into Windows itself for the purposes of backing up data, restoring it either through data loss or to additional machines. I'd recommend you look at a range of software from a business called Acronis. It's Acronis. They're famous for their backup software. They do everything from, very simple single machine backup software that's just more flexible and better than that built into Windows. As you would imagine, it has to be, because Windows has got backup facilities built into it. So if someone's going to make their money selling backup software, then it has to be better than what you get for free. And Acronis does that. So they have software that goes well into, the sort of network environment and allows you to back up from different machines. They have a lot of flexibility in the backups, that what is backed up and when, how it's scheduled. But in addition to that, there's a particular trick that Acronis can do, which might be of use to you, which is some of their software has the ability to restore to what's called dissimilar hardware. So let's say you've backed up your machine today, and tomorrow, heaven forbid, that machine dies, and you have to buy a new machine and reinstate everything onto that new machine. But the problem is the machine that died is 3 or 4 years old, and the new machine is different. How can you make sure that the software, that the image that you took of the old machine will run on the new machine? Normally that's not possible, because the old machine had different drivers installed on it for all the components that are specific to that machine, the graphics card, the sound card, whatever else that was attached to it. But what the Acronis software can do, or what some of their software can do, is a special trick where it will take the backup from the old machine and adapt it in such a way that you can reinstate that backup to a brand new dissimilar machine with different components in it, and still it will work. It will exchange the drivers for you and make it a fully functional machine. And in a business environment, that's really important, because it means you can get up and running very quickly. You don't have to spend 2 days rebuilding all the image on that machine by installing an operating system, then your apps, then the data, and then configuring all those apps. That will take days. Whereas this Acronis system will solve that problem, even when the new computer is different from the old.
Yeah. Neil, thank you. We've got Steve in Bristol with us as well. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Yeah, appreciate you waiting patiently to come on anyway. You've got a question for Fabs, haven't you?
Yes, I tried to do a couple of digital downloads over the Christmas period from a well-known online company. The first one didn't work. I got the refund for that.
Yep.
The second one has also had the same problems. Mm. Now they're downloading onto the Steam
yep.
network.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 10, 15 minutes of play, the PC just shuts down. Just completely shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this something to do with the games I'm downloading? Is it my PC? Is it a problem with the Steam network?
Yeah, it's interesting. Not possible to be definitive about this, but often when problems occur after a typical period of time, in your case, 10, 15 minutes, that can be a heat-related problem. It can be a heat-related problem. So,
yeah, I've seen that online, and, you know, there's no issues with the heat on my PC.
Mm. Okay. Is this a desktop PC or a laptop?
Desktop.
It's a desktop PC, and you're confident it's got good ventilation, no evidence of it becoming overly hot?
No, not at all.
And is it only on Steam games where this is happening? If you were to install... So Steam, by the way, for those that don't know, is a game service where the game is streamed onto the computer, and it's a way of getting a lot of games onto, you know, not very expensive hardware and quite cheaply accessing that. If you were to install a game, let's say a relatively modern game, not via Steam, but you were to install it as an app onto the PC and run it at, you know, full pelt, would it give you a similar problem? Have you tried that?
Well, it runs Call of Duty, the new one, absolutely fine.
Right, okay. So unlikely to be a heat issue then. Does it shut down randomly at any other times? What I'm wondering is now whether we have an issue with the power supply, maybe a hardware fault.
Is
it unique to? It's not unique to Steam. Okay, so then it is something to do with the Steam service and how it plays with your particular machine, and that might be a fault with the Steam service, or it could just be some form of compatibility issue. For those, you need to speak to the providers of the Steam service, because it's very specific. It doesn't sound like it's a general fault. It doesn't sound like it's a hardware fault or indeed any other fault with the machine. It sounds like it's a service, because you've done the test of running, you know, similar software, but not through the Steam settings. So I would say it's time. If you haven't, have you actually tried to reach out to Steam?
Well, yes, I have, with little success.
Yeah. Well,
because
they
refer me to the game developer. As Amazon did.
Yes.
So, yes, you have to go around the houses a bit on this.
It is difficult, but I think that, you know, it is on that side that the answer lies, that you have to, you know, you can go to the game developer or whoever's selling the software and, you know, get a refund as you did in the first instance, but that's possibly not the cause of the problem, although the game developer would probably have some insight into what's going on if you can get a reasonable reply. But I grant you, it is difficult. Have you tried using any other machines to run the same Steam software?
Well, this is the only one I've got, so yeah. I don't really have the option.
Okay. Well, I think it's going to be hard. I mean, my hope is that it's just particular titles. But you're not going to get very far with resolving this unless either you change your machine, which is a rather drastic solution, particularly given that we don't know exactly what the problem is, or you press them for replies. And there will be support pages, and maybe, you know, sometimes, for example, reaching out to them on the phone is sometimes, you know, not possible or not even the best way, but to you know, get a ticket number, raise an issue and ask them to escalate it. You know, when you get a sort of standard unhelpful reply, get them to escalate it, and, you know, say to them that's what you want to happen, and go through that process. Okay. But it's not easy. We do sometimes get to these sort of junctions where, you know, the sort of practical thing is play a different game. I mean, that's not a technical solution, but sometimes, you know, lives are busy, And, you know, we have choices and, you know, where do we want to spend our time? Because you could spend many hours unsuccessfully trying to get to the bottom of what this issue is.
Steve, thank you very much. Richard in Essex, he's got a question for you, Fevzi. Richard?
Yeah, morning, Doc. Morning, Fevzi. I use Microsoft Outlook as an email program, and it's worked fine for years. And all of a sudden, you get this thing, you realise you haven't had any emails for a couple of days, and then you get an email from them saying, please update your credentials because we cannot connect to the server. And I've had this before, and you do that, and you know, but about a few hours later, you suddenly get a great flood of emails, and it goes back to normal. Now, at the moment, ever since about halfway through November, it just will not connect. Now, I can still get it to TalkTalk email account. I can get it on the TalkTalk site, and I can get it on the Windows 2011 thing that came with the computer. They're fine. I particularly like the Outlook one. Is there anything I can do, or is this a common problem?
Okay, so sometimes the error message that you get isn't the true problem with not just with Microsoft, but certainly including Microsoft products. Your problem may not be related to connectivity. It may be related to the size of the file in which all the incoming emails are stored. Does the problem equally apply to emails that you try and send from your Outlook?
Yeah, you can't send anything either. It doesn't send or receive at the moment. Yeah. I mean, in the past, you've been able to reset the password and what have you. I mean, all three things, the TalkTalk, the Microsoft, and the Outlook, all use the same password. Because I've found before, if you change one, suddenly it won't, which is why I've had the problem in the past, it won't accept the incoming email. So I've done that, but it's nothing.
Okay. So it's unlikely that there's been a change in the incoming and outgoing mail servers. Those are the, you know, some of the things that you program in when you set up an email address, because it's still working on other devices. But it is worth, you know, looking up the text sheet for your email provider to find out what are the incoming and and outgoing mail servers. Are you using the optimal ones? The other thing that sometimes happens is that email setups become corrupted. You know, computers are not perfect, and for no apparent reason, sometimes settings that we've set up become corrupted, possibly because where they're stored on the hard drive, that bit of the hard drive has just, you know, developed a physical fault. So one possible solution is to make a record of all the information that you need to set up that email account. So that's, you know, obviously the email address itself, the password, the incoming and outgoing mail servers, any other settings relating to ports and so forth. Make a note of all of that, and you can look them up in Outlook as to what they are. You can then set up another email account, just call it something slightly different, and see if that works. So rather than trying to edit any email account, that this is often leads to problems in itself. It's often best to set it up again as a new account within Outlook, and then when it's working properly, delete the old one. And you know, you can change the send and receive group so they don't each download the same thing. But my suggestion would be to try that, because if it's working on other machines but it's not working there, it's likely to be the settings. But instead of trying to simply review and amend the settings, I would make a note of what the setting should be, disable the old account, set up a brand new account and see if that solves the problem. And often it will do. One final thing, and one thing that often happens with Outlook, and I'll just mention it for completeness. As far as the all your emails and everything else that Outlook can store, they're stored, depending on the version, they're typically stored in a single file called outlook.pst. That file can become too large. Yeah, it's a huge file. It's often the largest file on a Windows computer, because it stores all the emails, all the attachments, all the appointments, all the contacts that you might have in Outlook. And that's huge. So there's two things you can do. You can within Outlook, you can compress that file to squash it down and get rid of any sort of wasted space within it. And depending on what sort of drive you've got and the size of that file, that can take quite some time. But it's worth doing, because if nothing else, you'll recover some space from your hard drive. It would make the Outlook more snappy, and in some cases it solves this problem. if it solves the problem and then it comes back again after, you know, a few days or a few weeks or even a month or two, then what that tends to suggest is that the Outlook file is approaching its maximum that it's allowed. And what you can do is make changes to the version of the type of Outlook.pst file and allow it to have a larger amount of storage. Okay, so each generation of Outlook file had its own limit on file size, and what you can do is you can actually change that. You change the configuration of the Outlook.pst to allow bigger files, and the clue to whether that's the problem will be when you do the compression, whether that solves it, but then eventually the problem comes back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And Richard,
okay,
thank Richard, you.
I hope that's of some help.
Yeah, really appreciate it as well. Lots of texts and emails to get through as well. This one from John in Chelsea says, I keep getting a message on my phone and tablet saying my device has a many viruses install this app. Install this app. Is this a form of advertising?
Yeah.
Or is it based on phone?
It's probably, I mean, without seeing the message, it sounds like a fake message designed to trick you into believing that if you install this app, it's going to help. Now, if I'm right and that is a fake message, then you may already have some form of malware on your device. But even if that is the case, you don't want to follow the advice and install what they're suggesting, because that if this is malware, whatever it's suggesting is going to be malware as well. So instead of that, you need to try and uninstall any recently installed apps that you suspect may be malicious. Maybe do a bit of research on that app. When you download an app, for example, from an app store, and particularly from the Google Play Store, but you know you can also have problems with Apple's the Apple's iOS store as well. There's a few things you need to check before installing an app from an app store. One is, how long has that app been available? Has it just appeared in the last few days? Try and find an app that's been there for a long time and has got many reviews are spread over a long period of time that are positive, you know, people that look genuine. Look at the wording of those reviews, and if they're all very short reviews with similarly poor English, for example, again, that would be a suggestion that's a fake app. And also look very carefully at the name of the app that you install, because you think you're installing Facebook, but it's got three O's in book or something like that, or a double dot at the end, or something that makes it look like the Pucker app but really isn't. And this is a particular problem in the Google Play Store, because Google tend not to pre-vet the applications before they allow them onto the store. Apple is a bit stricter, but even Apple's system is not foolproof. So you know, it's a case of caveat emptor. Be very, very careful and go through those checks before you install something. And if you think you've installed something bad, uninstall it, see if the problem goes away. You can always reinstall it again later if you need to.
Yeah, I was caught out in a similar kind of thing, in a problem. Well, how was I to know that you spell Gucci with a U, not two O's? How was I to know?
It's a combination of Gucci and Google.
Mistake that anybody could make.
Of course. But it is, and sometimes there have been apps that have been downloaded millions of times by users before it's been realised that it's a fake version of, it's very similar to a Pucker app.
That didn't really happen to me. Come on, what'd you take me for? It was Rolex. How was I to know it wasn't spelt with a W? Fevzi Turkup is our gadget detective. Lots of questions, Fevzi. But first, Mark says, with regards to Stephen Bristol's download game problem, he's probably using Windows 7, but certain updates and security have caused problems with games even a few years old. And Frederick says, your instinct on overheating was probably correct. Could be the hard drive, Steam downloads compressed and all of that. And this question for you, straight off, is from Nigel in Bedford, who says, my Samsung Smart TV has stopped finding and connecting to the internet network. I've tried restarting the telly and rebooting my hub, all to no avail. Any advice or guidance would be appreciated.
Okay, Nigel. When you say it stopped connecting, maybe just let's look at that a little bit more carefully, because I know that some of the apps in Samsung and, in fact, other smart TVs don't get regularly updated and then cease to be supported. And that was an issue, for example, with regard to accessing BBC's iPlayer, where every year a whole raft of tellies cease to be compatible with iPlayer, not because, not I think because of the BBC's fault, but because TV manufacturers are actually quite poor at updating the software within the TV's smart area, as it were. So they'll give you YouTube and iPlayer and so forth, but if they don't update them, then often they just become incompatible. So that could be one area of a problem. It could also be that you might have had some change either in your router, that's the box that disseminates the internet around your home after it comes into your home, it sort of spreads it via Wi-Fi or cables. If you change the router or the settings on that router, particularly that if there are firewalls, a firewall built into that, that could actually be blocking it from accessing the internet as well. It's also possible that there's a hardware fault, but that's less likely. As a sort of piece of adjacent advice, if I could give it, I personally wouldn't ever pay extra money for a smart TV. If I'm buying a new TV and it happens to have that functionality already built into it, fine. But actually, the best way of achieving the benefits of smart TV, that's to say the ability to watch TV shows over the internet, to access YouTube and iPlayer and catch-up services and all of that, the best way of doing that is to get an add-on box and plug it into the HDMI, one of the spare HDMI connectors on the TV. It does use up one of those connectors, but because those people that make those boxes, so you've got, for example, the Roku box, that's R-O-K-U, you've got the Amazon Fire TV box, which is excellent, you've got Apple's Apple TV box, those are just little boxes, typically the size of, you know, like a hockey puck, that plug into your TV, attached to the internet, either wirelessly or via an internet Ethernet cable. Those have generally far more flexibility in terms of the range of services that you can access, but also those services tend to be kept up to date as well. So you're going to get a far richer and more reliable and dynamic experience by using one of those boxes. And some of those boxes are cheap. I mean, they start at about £50, go up to 70 or so. So, you know, in particular, if you're looking at TVs, you know, don't let the smarts sway you, because TV manufacturers are notorious for not updating the software in their TVs. They're used to making a product which they sell and then forget about. They're not like manufacturers of computers necessarily, or the divisions are not manufacturers of computers, where, you know, they have to provide driver support and compatibility support for new versions of operating systems and so forth. They're just used to selling you an item and forgetting about it, rather like a car.
Yeah, you
know, and that's a problem.
Philip references a conversation we had earlier about this flaw in Intel CPUs. He says, hopefully the recent security flaw in Intel CPUs will also raise knowledge of the hidden management engine. Acts like a hidden black box within a huge number of recent Intel CPUs.
Sort of the conspiracy side of things, you know, that there is undoubtedly stuff built into our technology that we're not made aware of, and functionality that we don't know about. And, you know, we've seen the ways in which, you know, security services around the world, you know, either insist on those things that being there or find them and leverage them themselves.
These computer manufacturers don't do themselves any favour with regards to trying to scotch conspiracy theories, when you think that they probably knew about this flaw in the system for some time, but they decided, as en masse, as a cartel, if you like, to not say anything about it, and then decided eventually to emit a joint statement about it. Mm. There's a kind of thing that fuels conspiracy theories, isn't it?
I guess, yeah, that's true. I guess the problem is, I mean, how long, if they did know, how long have they known? I mean, if they found out, you know, even 5 years ago, how easy is it to tell your customers that everything they've sold?
Well, you don't want to, though, do you?
No, you don't want to.
Whereas you should.
Yeah, and particularly these days when AMD, which was traditionally the, you know, the big rival to Intel in terms of computer chips, AMD has seen a resurgence for many years. Mm-hmm. I would only have recommended computers that had Intel processors, because the AMD stuff was slower and hotter and really only sold because it was cheaper. I say hotter, it means, you know, it used more energy, which made it more noisy, shorter life, all of those. But with their range of Ryzen processors, the AMD RYZEN Ryzen processors, they actually are competing successfully now for the first time in probably over a decade with Intel. So this would not be the time that Intel wants to draw attention. Intel's been really suffering as well, because Intel was the king of everything when it came to processors, when processors were things that only went into desktop computers and laptops. But with the advent of mobile phones and tablets, you know, these ARM-based processors, ARM, that use a completely different technology, they are the sort of dominant processor technology now. And Intel's are trying to play catch-up, because they're not as powerful. They use more battery life and, you know, run hotter and all the rest of it. So now Intel are in that position. So the world changed. It's a bit like being the manufacturer of the best horse-drawn carriages in the world, and you think that's what you do, and you make the best horse-drawn carriages, but you fail to understand what you actually are in the business of transportation, and that transportation evolves, you know, beyond just bumping. Because Intel have been lazy for some time, I would suggest, you know, making very small improvements from generation to generation. There used to be huge increases, and those increases have become small and incremental.
I know it's not a direct comparison, but imagine how outraged it would be if a car company talking of transport knew of a flaw in their motor cars and didn't let people know almost immediately, whether it was going to cost them billions or otherwise.
Anyway, amazing. Yeah, I could never imagine that happening.
Michael, how many
miles to the gallon does your car do?
That wasn't so much a flaw, though, was it? That was something that was that was basically a lie, but that wasn't a flaw. Did you know what I mean? A flaw can have all sorts consequences.
Yes, I mean,
that was a managed lie, wasn't it? You know, they knew there wasn't a flaw in the system, it's just that they lied.
Well, some might say deception, yes.
Yeah, but that's different from a flaw. If you see a flaw, which can have all sorts of consequences, then the customer should be informed immediately, shouldn't they? Anyway,
let's
do that to one side. Michael in London's with us. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Justin.
You're right.
Yeah, not too bad. Yeah, I was trying to go to sleep, but then I heard...
It's Goodness Samaritan. I didn't realise it was Goodness Samaritan. How are you? I haven't spoken to you in ages, mate.
I know, yeah. I've just been really, either really, really busy or haven't been put through.
Well, it's been a week of score draws for you, like, hasn't it?
Yes, very much so, and dodgy refereeing decisions.
Oh, you had to bring that in as well. We all suffer from those kind of things.
You know, I mean, Arsene Wenger's going to be in the stands for about eight games at this rate.
Well, forever, maybe. You never know. You never know. Anyway, you've got a techie question for Fabsy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try and be as clear as I can, because it's 8-year-old information. My telephone line comes into my hall, and
telephone line? What is that?
Sorry?
What is a telephone line?
A telephone line, where the cable comes into the telephone exchange box.
Are you saying that there's a wire connected to the telephone?
Sorry?
Are you saying that there's a wire connected to a telephone?
Yes.
What century are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about a computer I replaced 8 years ago.
But surely wires don't go to telephones, do they?
I've got the necessary filter, double filter on the phone downstairs, and I've got an extension lead running up to my bedroom for the telephone extension, and. So I can actually run my computer with broadband from my bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But The situation with the phone is I've got the necessary filter on the upstairs connection.
Yeah.
But for some reason, unless I've replaced my old handset from the 80s, but I've had to keep it and kept it plugged into my old Dell computer that I replaced 8 years ago into that phone socket at the back of the old Dell, which isn't turned on. And unless if I unplug that and don't keep my old landline phone plugged in there, my phones don't work.
Which is when you say they don't work, are they completely dead or noisy?
Completely dead.
Right. Okay. So you've got ADSL broadband, yes? It's sitting on your BT phone line. It's not super fast broadband. It's
super fast. Yeah, it's super fast broadband, and it's BT supply the cable. It's still to supply the cabling, but I'm actually with TalkTalk.
Yeah, but it's not fibre, is it? It's what they call ADSL. Is that right? So you've got.
The actual broadband is fibre.
Do you know what speeds you get?
The last time I checked, I got 36 megabits per second.
Right, fine. Okay, so it is super fast. And you've got a handset plugged into your PC, did you say?
No, I've got the old landline phone plugged in to the back of my old Dell I replaced 8 years ago into that phone socket.
Can you help Michael out of the dilemma that he is in, Fabsy, with
sure.
this landline business?
I think we have to do a sort of bit of analysis on this, try and simplify the circuits to see where the problem lies. Because when you've got so many things plugged in together, you've got the master socket, the extension and things hanging off that, you know, it's hard to know where the problem lies. So one thing that you could do, for example, for one thing, can I just ask, your router, the box, as we said, that disseminates the internet, is that plugged in to the master socket? That's to say, the first socket in the house that, as a wire comes into the house, as you say, is the router hanging off that one and not the one upstairs?
The actual router is upstairs.
Right. The router should be downstairs. It should be attached to the master socket. That's always the better way of doing it, rather than the extension. So I would change that if you can. That's the way I would put that. The other thing is, I would see if I could, those handsets that only work under certain circumstances, I would try and plug them directly into that master socket, i.e. the first socket that.
I've got a dual phone system, so the base for the phones is plugged into the whole socket.
Right, but I would unplug all the internet stuff and I just plug the phone into the socket. And actually, if your master socket is one of the newer ones, which typically have a horizontal line about a third of the way up across the front face of it, then inside the master socket will be a test socket as well, which bypasses everything, and you can plug directly into that if you've got one of the newer master sockets. But as a minimum, I would unplug all the internet stuff. I would plug those phones directly into the master socket with nothing else attached, no routers or computers or anything.
But my actual router is my router is physically plugged into my PC.
Yeah, but your router, that's fine. So that's an Ethernet cable, presumably from the router into the PC. But your router is also plugged into a non-master socket, and that's far from ideal. So I think two things. First of all, let's simplify it by testing the phones by plugging them directly into the master socket without anything else attached. And if there's more than one phone, plug them in one at a time and see if they work. If it doesn't then work, then you know you've either got a problem with the handset or a problem with the line, because you've simplified everything. And that's the point, by the way, at which you can ring BT about the... Are you paying TalkTalk for the line or BT for the line?
I'm paying TalkTalk, so and BT, as the usual setup, BT ring from the line.
Right.
I tried to ring BT, but they've got a message on their website. They only talk to BT customers.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying, because with TalkTalk, you can get your broadband from TalkTalk and rent the line from them, even though, you know, that was originally a BT installed line. But it's also possible to have BT line rental and, you know, Sky broadband or something like that. So that's why I was asking you, whoever you are a customer of for the line, at that point you would ring them up and try to get them to deal with it. So sounds like you might have to speak to TalkTalk about that. So good luck.
And BT actually tell you they only talk to BT customers. They're having a laugh, aren't they?
Well, it's because when you've got sort of a company like TalkTalk providing you with a phone line service,
what
they're really doing is they're taking responsibility for the billing and the customer service and the fault reporting.
Yeah, I do get it. But you are somewhere down the line, BT is earning off whatever you're paying TalkTalk, is the point I'm making.
So everybody
then is a BT customer, essentially. Really.
BT or Openreach, yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah.
So, yes, I mean, the argument is...
Openreach is part of BT?
Openreach increasingly becoming independent now. I mean, there were attempts to break it away fully. I think that they've got some sort of arm's length arrangement at the moment.
Okay,
But the point is, the router's plugged into the wrong place, and I think you should be simplifying things. So where you've got everything plugged in all together, it's impossible to know where the fault is. But if you simplify it, plug in one thing at a time and test it, then you start to be able to deduce where the problem lies.
Anyway, at the end of the day, Michael, I know you only want to fix this to watch Arsenal TV, but if you've missed out on the last 10 episodes, you can always catch up with the next one, if you know what I mean. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Adrian in Essex, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? You good?
I'm very well. I hope you all are too.
We are. Thank you,
Adrian.
Yeah. What's your question?
Okay.
Yeah.
So my question is that I have a new laptop with Windows 10 and an older external optical drive that won't work anymore.
Yep.
So if I put in a film DVD, it just goes into a loop. And of course, games won't load at all.
Yeah. Okay. So there are essentially two reasons, other than hardware fault, which I doubt, why an optical drive like that would stop working with a new operating system. One is the lack of a suitable driver having been installed or existing.
That was my guess.
Yeah.
The manufacturer's site says that they've stopped updating this model for Windows 10. I wondered whether that meant there was no solution, and that was the issue.
The fact that they don't create a separate Windows 10 driver might indicate that they realise it doesn't work, and they're not. It's expensive because they're not making any more money on that. They've sold it. And we were talking about this in the context of cars, you know, that people sell cars and largely, you know, they then find another customer to sell a car to. But with this sort of equipment, the companies are expected to support it and put money into, you know, software engineers and so forth for years afterwards to make sure those things still run. You know, you don't find people, you know, car manufacturers having to update cars so they can drive on new types of road or something. You know, it's not like that. So it could be that, you know, they're not updating the driver and therefore it's never going to work. Or it could be that it works, you know, the driver for the Windows 7 driver works on Windows 10, but it's not supported. In other words, in the future, if Microsoft change Windows in such a way that it doesn't work well or it's buggy, that they won't then support it, so they're warning you now. So that's one possibility. And another possibility is that you need to install an application onto Windows 10 to allow you, because the driver will only give you the most basic functions of that CD or DVD drive. It won't necessarily give you the full features that you might have had baked into Windows 7 or installed on Windows 7. So you can look at sort of different applications like, you know, VLC Media Player or others.
Okay, I've done that.
Yeah,
I've tried VLC Media Player and it's had no no benefit. Mm.
Does your operating system see the drive? Does it recognise the drive as being attached?
Yes, it does.
It does. Does it allow you any functionality of the drive at all?
It starts to play a movie.
Yeah.
But then that's only the first few minutes, and then it goes into a loop and repeats itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That doesn't sound like a driver issue. That sounds like an application issue to me. So I would say, okay, you didn't strike gold with VLC.
No.
Try some others. Try ones that are, you know, commercial packages with free trial period, so you'll know if it works for you. Don't go around the sites downloading lots of random free software, because a lot of that's got malware in it. Yeah, there's some very good free software out there, but if you don't know which titles to look for and you don't download them from a trusted source, you know this is one of the ways that viruses and infections get onto computers, when people start, you know, randomly looking for a, you know, something to do, a file conversion or, you know, some sort of utility that they need, and they start looking for free stuff. My advice would be to go for one of the paid for pieces of software, look around for those, and look for one that's got the ability to, you know, try it free for a period.
Yeah, Adrian, thanks very much for the call. 0808 590 9693. If you've got another question for, or any questions for Fevzi in the next half hour, you've got your opportunity to pose them right to him or text him on 85058. Email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. Nadine says very quickly, Fevzi, I recently got a Kindle Paperwhite. It came with a USB cable but no charger plug. Do I need to buy a dedicated Kindle plug costing £18?
No.
Or can I use my iPhone plug?
No. You can plug that cable. The reason why they've stopped putting the brick bit on it is that we, you know, most people have so many of
computers,
these
computers,
things. Yeah. Oh, so yeah. You can, for example, if you've got a computer, plug it into the USB socket on the computer. If you've got any other, you know, mobile phone charger or other small brick charger, then you can often just pop out the cable at the plug end, the bit that goes into the wall. There's a USB cable, and plug in your one, and you know, Bob is your proverbial. So the only difference that you will really find is that some of these chargers and sockets will charge faster than others, but actually the Kindle is a low power device, and it doesn't have a huge big battery. It's not a laptop or something like that. So even, you know, keeping it topped up from a USB socket on a computer will do you fine. And that's the reason why they've done it. You don't have to buy one of theirs. If I was going to buy a third party one, you know, not a Kindle one, you need to be a bit careful, Nadine, with this, because you don't want to, if you don't want to go for the branded one because it's expensive, nor do you want to go for the very cheapest ones, because there lies, you know, the danger of some of those not being safe. You know, it beggars belief that people spend the better part of £1,000 on a smartphone, but when they want to buy a sort of replacement or second charger, they get one for £3 on well-known auction website. And that's really, you know, you're taking a chance with that. You're taking a chance with your device and fire risk as well.
Don't get me wrong, I didn't spend £1,000 on the phone, but I did spend about 150, I think, on the charger.
Yeah, so you don't want to be spending
I know, but it's tempting, isn't it? Because you think they all look alike.
The problem is they do all look alike, and some of the fakes have got even, you know, kite marks on them and safety marks on them that are not real. They're not justified. Mm. They've just copied them and put them on there. So you need to get a decent brand, but also get it from a reputable retailer, you know, never knowing the undersold or tall women or whatever it is, you know, one of those.
Tall women, I haven't come across that one, but okay. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So do that. I mean, I'll mention a couple of brands that I've had success with, which are not expensive, but are still good quality. Anker, A-N-K-E-R, do a lot of these charger-type products. Mm. And the RAV brand as well, R-A-V. Okay. So those ones are good.
Fevzi, Scott says, hello, my Apple PC browser was hacked when I thought I was updating my Flash player. Now I can't change my homepage back or system restore it, and basic stuff like copy and paste no longer work. What can I do? Is there any software that will fix it? Yours desperately.
Yeah. So take one step back. This is the reason why every computer should have at least two browsers on it. So, you know, you could have Safari if it's an Apple, but also Firefox or whatever, because often the way that you need to install a fix for something is to use the browser that's still working. If you've messed up your browser or it's become messed up through infection, this becomes a problem. If you've got an Apple computer, you can restore the operating system and the browser directly from Apple's own website. You can do it that way, or you can download an alternative browser from another machine. And as we mentioned with the antivirus earlier on in the program, you can actually then install it from something like a USB drive and go at it that way. Apple have got quite good repair facilities for their software as well, so you can use those as well. But it is a problem, and I guess the sort of the cautionary tale is, be really careful when you're applying updates to make sure that they are what they say they are and they come from a legitimate source. And the updating of Flash on machines is one of the most common ways in which people get infected, because there's a lot of malware that purports to be Flash update, because Flash gets regular updates, so people tend to do that. Apple don't like Flash anyway, so and probably with good cause.
I've just bought, this is from Eddie, I've just bought an antivirus 5 user license from a retailer for less than £25 with the electronic download code, which first installs itself before uninstalling the old one of the same brand. Mm. It also uninstalls any so-called former free antivirus originally installed on the computer. Do it every year, as I've got 4 laptops around the home. The most economical way of doing it, as this offsets the higher online renewal fees, says Eddie. Anyway. That was some advice, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. Some antivirus programs do uninstall anything else that was there before it, but not all of them do it, and not all of them do it as well. So one tip I would give you is to run a program called CCleaner, which is a free software, but actually a very good one. So that's the letter C followed by the words cleaner, all one word, so CCleaner. Mm-hmm. And what that does is, amongst other things, is when you run it, it will delete all the dregs that are left behind when a program is uninstalled, because a program is not just one file that you then delete and the program is gone. A modern application is made up of thousands or even, you know, tens of thousands of files that sit in different parts of your hard drive, which collectively form an application. And when you get an uninstaller, it hunts around to uninstall. But if it's not the uninstaller made by the company who made the software that's being uninstalled, if it's a generic uninstaller, then things tend to get left behind. You know, bits of some of those files get left behind. They can cause instability. They can cause slowness. You lose space on your hard drive. So something like CCleaner, if you set it up, install the free version. You don't need the paid version. Just install the free one. And if you set it up to run automatically every time you start your computer, it's a gentle program that will tend to do a sort of spring cleaning every time your computer starts up, and just help it run a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So I would say, even if you run an uninstaller or you let the antivirus uninstall any previous versions, once that's done, run CCleaner to tidy up, you know, the dregs, as it were.
Richard in Oxford says, with the 5G rollout coming soon, is there any phones for around £100 that I'd be really, really good on, and on an Android system, you want to know?
I would hold off buying anything that, you know, with a view to 5G at the moment, because it's still some way away. And even when they rolled it out, it won't be, you know, national all at once. And the first generation of 5G phones won't be great either. So given that, you know, these phones are not cheap, you know, even the Android versions, I would wait. I wouldn't, you know, go ahead. You know, companies would be far better implementing proper 4G speeds before they start worrying about 5G, because actually the 4G that we get in this country is pretty poor compared to, you know, many other countries. We're not getting what most of the world would think of as proper 4G speeds. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I would quite like it if I could still I could make a voice phone call without it dropping every few minutes.
Yeah, gosh.
You know, it's so funny that we have all of this technology, and you know, we have all this advanced technology, artificial intelligence, everything built into our smartphones. But actually, they've got worse at making phone calls. I know that's only one of their tricks now. But you know what? It would be nice if my smartphone could still make. Because what happened, if you remember the original mobile phones, they had whodging grey aerials sticking out of them, looking like, you know, fingers, as it were. That was a good aerial. And we didn't want that, so we started building it into the phone. Then we turned them into smartphone, and we crammed in all these other electronics, still further limiting the space for a decent antenna and an amplifier circuit. And the result of that is they do all these other things, fantastic. Calls are terrible, or can be terrible. Yeah.
And that's, you never know whose fault it is, whose phone. I mean, it happened to me just yesterday, and I was like, oh, was it my phone that dropped out, or was it your phone? Yeah. And then the worst thing of all, if you don't mind me saying so, I know it's not very technological, is there's no protocol as to who should call back, because what happens is you both call back, and you're both engaged as a result of that, because you both think, oh, it was my phone that dropped out, or it was your phone that dropped out. There should be a protocol. I think the person that made the initial call should be the person to call back. So the person who received the call should stand off and wait for a couple of minutes till the person
calls. Which is the equivalent of bumping into someone in the street, and you, both of you move to the left, and then both of you move to your to the right, and you do this dance.
Well, in that protocol, I always feel the person who's the taller should be the one to...
Should just barge their way through.
No, to step over the other person, you know, rather than go to the left or the right. Just step over them, yeah.
Yes, why not?
I'm just trying to solve the world's problems. Dennis in Grantham says, I recently purchased a Samsung MU6400.
Okay.
Smart TV. You mentioned that smart TVs are not that smart earlier on. I plugged in a friend's Amazon Fire Stick and the TV could identify it, but I couldn't open it up to view. Any ideas?
So the Amazon Fire Stick is an alternative to the smarts inside a smart TV. So it's not really designed to work in conjunction with, other than, you know, it plugs into the HDMI socket, which is the... one of the digital sockets in the computer, in the TV, that allows you to have picture and sound. But the Amazon Fire Stick will pick up its own signal, typically via Wi-Fi, and then use the screen just to display it. So it's a different format. Instead of being a little hockey puck-sized box that plugs in via a cable, it looks like a sort of a slightly fat USB thumb drive, but instead of having a USB, it's got an HDMI connector, and it just plugs straight into the back. All you really need to be able to view the output of a Fire Stick is to make sure that, you know, the button on a TV set is typically a rectangle with an arrow going into it from the side, and that's the button that typically allows you to select the input. So do you want the TV to display from the aerial input? Do you want it to display HDMI 1, HDMI 2, AV1, whatever the socket is. So all you really need to do is press that button repeatedly until you see the input relating to the Amazon device and any program that it's showing or any screen that it's showing.
David Darlison says, and that's in the West Midlands, in case you didn't know, he says, could you ask your techie expert if it's possible to convert my TV and hi-fi speakers to facilitate Bluetooth? Show your age.
Yeah, it is. So well, no, that's not, don't need to be old to answer that question.
Young Bluetooth. What is that?
Yeah, okay. So Bluetooth is a wireless technology that's designed it's designed not for long distance. I think it's up to 66 feet currently. But it's designed to replace wires. So yeah, you can get a little dongle that picks up a Bluetooth audio stream. And then feeds that into, say, for example, an auxiliary input socket on an amplifier or on the back of a TV set and so forth. So if you've got a suitable input, yes, you can do it. And it's not a bad way to work. You can also do it via some of these sort of speaker units that you can get. So again, you know, companies like Anchor and Kitsound, for example, do Bluetooth speakers with an audio output as well. So you can use a speaker as a speaker when you want to. You can connect to it via Bluetooth, that's to say wirelessly, or using a wire. And then you can take an output from some of these devices as well into another device, such as a TV set. So and then it can act as a speaker as well for the TV if you wire it correctly.
You've mentioned Anker a couple of times tonight, and of course other butter firms are available. This is from Ryland.
A-N-K-E-R, thank you. But also Kitsound are good for this sort of thing, and I've mentioned Rav as well. So
Mick in Northern Ireland is with us. Good morning, Mick.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
Good. So you've got a question for Fevzi, yeah?
Yes, I wonder if it's possible to, if there's a programme which would allow you to download music from YouTube onto a memory stick, which you could then play.
Of course, the line's so bad. We were just talking about bad lines a moment ago, weren't we? Hopefully we'll be able to get you back in a moment. I think I got the gist of it. If there's a program that enables you to put YouTube onto a memory stick.
Yeah, so this is against, doing this is against YouTube's terms of service, because what YouTube want you to do is stream their content, their videos that they host, because that then enables them to serve up advertisements within it and also to control the user experience. So it's partly to do with user experience, but it's mostly to do with not wanting to cut out advertisements. So given that it is against their terms of service, what I will say, I will not name a piece of software that does this, but I will tell you that there are plenty of pieces of software out there. What tends to happen is they tend to work for a while, then YouTube will make a change and render them inoperable, and then the software manufacturer will amend their software, and so the game of cat and mouse goes. But there are plenty of them. Some of them are free. Again, take my warning that if you're using free software, make sure that it's a well-respected, well-understood, well-reviewed piece of software that's been around for a while. Don't just download the first thing that you find. There's also paid for software that will do much the same thing as well. So the short answer is yes, there's plenty of softwares that can do this, but just be aware that you're breaking the YouTube terms of service.
Great. And Mick, does that work for you? Do you understand all that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not there. Terribly good with computers. I'm of an older generation. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, would you just Google these to find out how you get them, or how would you go about? I don't even know how you go about getting them.
Yeah. So if you were to search for YouTube video downloader, yeah, that will get you plenty. But you need to do a bit of. It's a bit awkward, Mick, because I don't want to mention any names here, because I don't want to encourage people to break. You're not breaking any laws, but it's a free service, but you're meant to stick to their rules. If you use their service, you're meant to stick to their rules. So I don't really want to do too much to enable people to get around that. But all I would say is it's very commonly done for a variety of legitimate reasons. But
gentlemen wouldn't do that, would they? Gentlemen wouldn't do that. We are gentlemen.
I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that I wouldn't encourage it, don't you know? If you do some Google searching, but then don't just download the first thing that comes up on Google, particularly if it's got the word ad in a box, because with a Google search, the things that come up at the top are not the most relevant. They are the ones that some company has paid them to put at the top. Yeah, and those ones have got a little ad logo against it. Do a bit of research. Do read some reviews. When you see some products, put in the name of that product then, and then the word review next to it, and read some reviews and do some research that way. But do bear in mind that most of these solutions stop working, and you have to sort of either update the software or change the software.
Right.
And some of them even have legal action taken against them by.
Do you see why gentlemen and ladies wouldn't do that?
I don't want that
at all, mate. Yeah. Mick, thank you. A really good question as well, by the way, because at least
thank
we're able to
much.
Discuss it.
Thank
yeah.
You.
Yeah. Thank you. A lot of people have been texting. You'll be not pleased to hear, Fevzi, about the suggestion about the modern technology and the old way of doing it. Somebody suggested that any old Tom, Dick or Harry can still complete an abacus quicker with their feet than many supercomputers. It's not strictly true.
No, but that's quite nice to think about.
It's not strictly true.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I remember sort of editing with tape, and I remember the old Ewers. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, Ewers, of course I do. Yeah,
those old portable machines
in a bag.
But then you know it's quite possible to get sort of nostalgic about things like mini discs, which had many of the same advantages.
Of course, that didn't last long, did it?
Well, in radio studios, it did.
Well, we thought it would last forever in radio studios,
but it had the benefits of editability in you know, being able to cut in a similar way that you cut with tape, but then have the sort of direct accessibility of CD and the quality of digital. The reason it didn't last long was Sony did their usual thing of pushing their own proprietary format. So instead of using, you know, MP3 or something, something called A-track, A-T-R-A-C. And you know, we had similar problems. But they're still pushing their version
But it was also competing with other rivals like DAT machines. Remember, there was a moment when we thought the DAT machine would take over from the mini disc. Do you remember that?
But no, because DAT was never going to do that.
It was a better quality, though, wasn't it?
Yes, but hugely expensive to make a DAT head assembly, you know, the actual read and write. DAT assembly was more like a video cassette recorder.
This ain't cricket, but I think Jonathan Overend's got a comment on this, because you remember those days, Jonathan?
Oh, my goodness. I was having a clear out the other day, opened the lid off this box, and there was a whole box of mini discs in there, and I thought I'd woken up and gone back to 1998. We used to use them. You know, we were talking about reel-to-reel tape. Goodness me, the BBC thought it had transported itself into the 22nd century when it moved to mini-disc. That didn't last long, as you say.
I think I bought one of the very last mini-disc players, because I couldn't afford the mini-disc recorder like the BBC could. I think I bought the very last one, and the bloke in the shop looked at me as if I was Cat Weasel when I came in to buy it. I'm just saying. We'll catch up with you in Ebony very shortly, Jonathan.
Always ahead of the game,
Doc. Exactly. Fevzi, thank you very much.
Cheers, Dawson. Can I just say Twitter @GadgetDetective if you didn't get your question answered tonight?
BBC Five Live.